Well, they call it the rat race, this daily grind that we find ourselves to be a part of. I think rat race is quite a good name for it, actually. I don't know about you. Because in many ways it does resemble being on a sort of a treadmill, doesn't it? In general terms, it consists of getting up in the morning to go to work. You work so that you can have money to buy food, so that you can come home and eat it. And with a little bit of diversion, maybe consisting of a bit of TV or a bit of sport or some kind of relaxation or music or whatever it is you do, you then basically go to bed so that you will have enough rest, so that you've got the energy to get up in the morning to go to work, to buy the food to come home to eat, to get up in the morning to go to work, to buy the food to come home to eat, and so on and so forth. For some years, of course, the very frustration of not being... For some people here, of course, the very frustration of not being able to do all of that because of unemployment or illness is quite rightly a huge frustration and very difficult. And if that's you this morning, then I want to acknowledge that that is really hard, not being able to be a part of that rat race. And for others, retirement has left them feeling rather out of it. The whole world seems to be ploughing on, and you feel a bit left behind. And again, if that's you, then we need to acknowledge that that is hard too. And somehow, running on the treadmill, it has seemed to take on a kind of meaning and purpose all of its own, hasn't it? This idea of, again, everyone go to work, buy food, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da, it feels like a purpose in its own right. See if you recognize it as I continue the description for a moment. You see, what's interesting is that this rat race has its own set of rules and regulations, depending on which particular track you run. Truth is talked about, but the ethics of the rat race mostly consist of whatever you can get away with, since the only accountability in the rat race is to other rats. And people just see where they fit into that. The rat race also has its own value system that serves to support it. And that value system changes all the time. So 100 years ago, the value system of the rat race basically focused on survival. But today it's far more complex than that. The rewards consist of everything from the very latest gadget to luxury, to the ability to go on luxury holidays, maybe to simply the entitlement for me time. As the name has developed, me time, this time when it's just for you and nobody and nothing else, and you just owe it to yourself. The poor rats that can't afford either the gadgets or the holidays or even just the me time, those poor rats, well, really, they're to be pitied. And no matter what you believe or who you are, woe betide you if you dare to question anyone's right to their reward from the rat race. In fact, if you dare to question anyone's right to their reward from this book, the Bible, instantly you get accused of being a Pharisee. And how dare you? Am I right? I think that's the way the rat race works. Well, let me give you the Bible's name for rat race. Welcome to Babylon. That's exactly what's described here in Revelation chapter 18. Welcome to Babylon, the godless society portrayed in the previous chapter as, in very stark terms, as the great prostitute that seduces mankind and whose final judgment is detailed in our chapter this morning for the declared purpose of helping you and me to recognize and to escape from its clutches. That's why this material is here. See, like so many other occasions, this book of Revelation, this book of unveiling, as it swept across history from one side to another, and then from another side to another, and then on this final sweep across history, just to kind of see the end of what's going on, as it sweeps across history. So here in chapter 18, we find ourselves focusing in on one particular aspect of history that we need to understand. That's what it's done time and again. As it swept across history, it's picked up particular points and zoomed in on them so that you can see the detail and get to grips with the important bit. It happened on the previous occasion, chapter 7, and with the seals, and on chapter 11 with the trumpets. And on those two occasions, it kind of swept across history and stopped and said, meanwhile, the church, and this is what's happening to God's people. And it did the same thing, as I say, in chapter 11. It swept across history with the trumpets, the punctuation of what's going on in history, and stopped and said, meanwhile, the church, this is what's happening. Well, this time we've almost finished the whole book. Not quite. After the summer, we will do chapters 19 through to 22 and glory and delight in doing so. But on this occasion, in this account of history, as the end game is coming about, so this isn't in chapter 18, meanwhile, the church. It is rather, look, church, this is what's going to happen. So it's pausing, as it were, so that you and I, if we're Christians, can focus on the big picture, see society from heaven's point of view, and understand where we fit or maybe don't fit into it. It's all here so that the church can respond to what God is doing. And the first thing that chapter 18 tells us is that the rat race is stopped. Look at verse 1 with me and you'll see what I mean. After this, says John, I saw another angel coming down from heaven. He had great authority, and the earth was illuminated by his splendor. With a mighty voice he shouted, Fallen! Fallen is Babylon the Great! She has become a home for demons and a haunt for every evil spirit, a haunt for every unclean and detestable bird. For all the nations have drunk the maddening wine of her adulteries, and the kings of the earth have committed adultery with her, and the merchants of the earth grew rich from her excessive luxuries. Remember that what we're seeing here is the history of the world from heaven's point of view. It's very important that we grasp that, because otherwise the figurative language will leave us completely left behind. This is the history of the world from heaven's point of view. And there is far too much detail to cram into a book. I remember when we started Revelation, I showed you an A-level textbook on, I think, the 6 years of the Russian Revolution, and it was called An Introduction to the Russian Revolution, and it was that thick. Well, imagine if the whole of the world's history from heaven's point of view were written down. Can you imagine how many books there would be? It would be impossible, wouldn't it? So what happens here, very cleverly, is that word pictures, caricatures have been painted in the book of Revelation so that we can grasp what's going on from heaven's point of view and cut through some of the detail. And in this vision that John saw, as the angel, meaning the messenger from God, comes down, there is no doubt, as you look at him in verse 1, as to what authority he comes with, nor for the purpose for which he has come. The glory and the splendor of God are unmissable, and the condemning words are clear. Pick up verse 2 again with me. With this mighty voice, he shouted. I'm not going to shout, but with this mighty voice, he shouted. In other words, so everyone can hear, fallen. Fallen is Babylon the Great. She's become a home for demons and a haunt for every evil spirit, a haunt for every unclean and detestable bird. In other words, this city, this Babylon, which we understood from the previous chapter to be a caricature of godless society is totally corrupt, that's the message of verse 2, and its end has arrived. Now think about that for a minute. A point will come when God will say, stop. Godless society, stop. Rat race, stop. To illustrate the point, pictures are picked up that are described in Isaiah chapter 13 of the condemnation and destruction of the actual city of Babylon some 600 or 700 years before this. And the angel makes clear that this is a place where the devil feels at home. You can pick it up in verse 2, can't you? A place where evil can simply have its way. That's what it means by a haunt for every evil spirit and a home for demons. It's a place where evil is comfortable. Just like in Romans chapter 1, where Paul describes the godlessness of men who and women who don't want to know God. They turn their back on God, despite the fact that God is clear in society and in creation. And men and women turn their back on God, and he gives them over. Kind of says, okay, you don't want God? Fine, you get on with it then. He gives them over, says Romans chapter 1, to godlessness, which is exactly what's demanded. Well, verse 3 makes that clear, but in doing so, in verse 3 of our passage, the whole place is turned into a disaster zone. And God's people need to hear the judgment. If you are a Christian this morning, you need to hear the condemnation. Because otherwise we won't understand the need for verse 4. Look, he says, godlessness has taken hold. It's a haunt for what it is. All the nations have been completely carried away. Verse 3, then I heard another voice from heaven say, come out of her, my people, so that you will not share in her sins, and so that you will not receive any of her plagues. Here's a caricature of godless society with all its evil and just its rat raceness. And the message from heaven is, if you're a Christian, out you come. I don't know about you, but when I read that, that sounds just about one of the most confusing things the Bible has ever told me to do. Hang on a minute. It's an absolutely astonishing thing to say, isn't it? That single phrase, come out of her, my people. Well, that command from heaven has absolutely massive implications, doesn't it? You and I are a part of the rat race. We just are. We can't help it. We're born into it. We walk it every day. We get up in the morning to go to work, to buy the food, come home to eat, and blah, 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 blah. That's just what we do. How can God's people, how can Christians come out of her? How can you divorce yourself from godless society? If we've understood the last couple of chapters correctly, Babylon isn't exactly a single place you can just leave. Well, it was, the real one was, but this figurative one described in these pictorial terms in Revelation, it isn't like you can just move, is it? Some commentators strongly argue that this picture in Revelation 18 is talking about Rome. Well, that was certainly the place of excess of its day. But A, that would make it irrelevant for us. And B, Rome wasn't the only place of excess of its day. You want to point the finger at Rome? Well, you may as well point it at Corinth as well, or at Ephesus as well, or at Athens as well. All of which were godless societies. Which one are the Christians supposed to leave? All of them? Well, that makes the New Testament all a bit pointless, doesn't it? And it makes it thoroughly irrelevant to us. And anyway, Rome still does exist. I've never been there, but I've got friends who have. And albeit that it's been through tough times in history, it certainly does exist. It doesn't fulfill the description that is here. So how can we come out of a godless society, as this is telling? Or is it just that the Bible is completely out of touch and irrelevant? Well, no, we don't believe that. What on earth can it mean? Unless, I suppose, one way of looking at it would be that Christians are simply to up sticks and go live in isolated monasteries or settlements somewhere. Do you know what would happen if we did that? Very, very quickly, those monasteries or isolated settlements would develop their own godless society. Yeah. And the whole thing would start again. I think some of the answer is found in the rest of verse 4. Just have a look. Come out, it says, so that you will not receive any of her plagues. That is, come out so that you won't be caught up in the consequences that will ensue from God turning his back. So that you will not share in her sins, and so that you will not receive any of her plagues. Come out so that you're not a part of what's going on here. What sins? What consequences? What plagues? Well, follow the passage and actually it becomes clear. Verse 5. For her sins are piled up to heaven, says verse 5, and God has remembered her crimes. Give back to her as she has given. Pay her back double for what she has done. Mix her a double portion from her own cup. Give her as much torture and grief as the glory and luxury she gave herself. In her heart she boasts, I sit as a queen. I'm not a widow. I'll never mourn. Well, she's about to be proved wrong. Again, back in Romans 1, the Apostle Paul describes in graphic terms that when God says, all right, you want to be godless? Go ahead and be godless. I'll turn my back on you. When he does that, all sorts of horrible chaos of society starts to take hold. And the society gets its just deserts. But here it's more ferocious than that. In Romans chapter 1, society that God turns his back on is kind of left to get its own desserts, and there's a passivity to God. He's like he's not doing anything. He is, but it's like it's presented like he's not doing anything. Here, he's much more active. People speak of God as being loving and patient and forgiving and tolerant, and that is true. But while God, the God of the Bible, is immensely patient and unconditionally loving, what he is not and will not ever be is unjust. He will not allow godlessness to continue without consequence. He won't just say, okay, you get on with it then. I made you. I'm going to leave you to your own devices and let you enjoy yourselves. He's not going to do that. The God of the Bible will not do that, and neither should we want him to. Remember, as Christ died on the cross, it was all about him being completely engaged in society. As he hung on the cross, it was all about God taking your sin and mine and collecting it, as it were, in a cup and pouring it on Christ so that he took the punishment that we deserve. God, the consequence of a godless society is seen at the cross. God is involved and he does care. And for those who will put their faith and trust in Jesus, they'll be rescued from that godless society and the consequences of it. But we also need to remember, and that's what this passage is about, that those who reject his rescue will bear the judgment themselves. So the terms in which this is described in verse 5 are deliberately graphic so that we get the message loud and clear. Remember, Babylon gets its name, we saw last week, from Babel. What was Babel famous for? The tower that men sought to create early on as humankind walked the earth. And as they built that tower, it was so they could make a name for themselves and kind of challenge God. Well, with a nod to the Tower of Babel, the idea that led to Babylon in the first place. This godless society has its sins that are piled up, in other words, in a tower, verse 5, to heaven. And God has remembered. This godless society has empty boasts like, I'm a queen, meaning I'm entitled to luxury all the time. How dare anybody question my word or my will? I'm not a widow, meaning I need never be sad. Life is a smile every day. I haven't got any problems, so I never need to mourn either. There's nothing ever for me to be sorry for. That's the way it's caricatured, verse 7. I'm a queen. I'm not a widow. I will never mourn. And those words, verse 8, will prove empty. Therefore, in one day, her plagues, the consequence of her actions, what godless society deserves, will overtake her. Death and mourning and famine. See, it's a reversal of the luxury and the sadness. She will be consumed by fire, for mighty is the Lord God who judges her. Verses 1 to 8 spell out for us the consequence of godless society. No matter what it thinks, one day God will say, enough. The rat race will be stopped. If you and I tomorrow morning look out on a world as we go to work, you go to work and get involved in just the rat race and running the board, suddenly don't forget, you see, don't forget this is not going to go on forever. But you want to ask the question, well, what's it done that's so wrong? With the rat race stopped, well, let's see what it's done wrong. Because its participants are shocked, which is the next section, verses 9 to 20. We're not going to read all the songs of lament that follow from the participants in verses 9 to 20 but because of time. But cast your eye across verses 9 to 20, will you? And you'll see the reaction of the participants. So the kings of the earth, for example, were smitten by the godless society. They committed adultery with her. They got completely stuck in, totally carried away. They used it, and it used them. Now they stand off after this destruction, terrified, and cry, verse 10, woe, woe, O great city, O Babylon, city of power. In one hour your doom has come. And the merchants, those who simply got rich, selling, as verses 11 and 12 describe, anything and everything. Just cast your eye across verses 11 and 12, will you? At the different things that were sold there. Cargoes of gold, verse 12, silver, precious stones, pearls, fine linen, purple, silk, scarlet cloth, blah, 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 blah. It goes on. Cinnamon, horses and carriages, bodies and souls of men. Can you see? Those merchants, right the way down to selling people, they will weep and mourn because they won't get rich anymore. When God says enough to godless society, suddenly it looks as if the end has come, and who's going to be upset? Well, the power brokers will be upset, that's for sure, the kings and the leaders, but also those that trade on everything, that support the godless society, they're going to be upset. And just like the kings, they've got the same cry. Look, verse 16, woe, oh great city. Dressed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, and glittering with gold and precious stones and pearls. In 1 hour, such great wealth has been brought to ruin. So the power brokers, well, they hit the rocks. And the merchants, they hit the rocks. And then slightly bizarrely, the sea captains, the sailors, the fishermen, in other words, those who relied on a godless society to earn their living. So you can kind of blame the kings, can't you, and say, you should have known better, and you flirted and you got your just desserts. And the merchants, they profited from the godless society. But these guys, the sea captains, the transport people, which is who they all are. Verse 18, when they see the smoke of her burning, they will exclaim, was there ever a city like this great city? And they will throw dust on their head and with weeping and mourning cry out, woe, woe, O great city, where all who had ships on the sea became rich through her wealth. In 1 hour she's been brought to ruin. In other words, godlessness will get its just deserts and there will be utter ruin. That's what this chapter wants us to get. And all the claims of living like being like a queen and living in luxury, of not being a widow, of never being sorry, they will be seen as hollow and empty boasts that they were. Now, I don't know about you, but when I read all of that stuff and I think about the godless society, the rat race in which you and I live, it all sounds a bit vindictive. I can't say I read this chapter with any great sense of, oh, goody. No. In fact, if it all sounds rather vindictive, but just stop and think for a moment about the obvious signs that the society, the rat race in which we live, is godless. Just think about it for a moment. The stuff that we turn a blind eye to quite a lot of the time. The stuff that you don't really talk about in polite society, and certainly not over coffee after church. We know, for example, that in our country, human trafficking is rife. Tens of thousands of people are brought in all the time under false pretenses and put into all sorts of things, situations, including prostitution. What drives human trafficking in a society like ours? You know what it is? Greed. That's what drives it. Let me bring it home a little bit closer. What caused the banking crisis that has left millions on the dole? Where banks offered mortgages of 125% of what houses were worth. We're all blaming the bankers for that, but who took out all those mortgages at 125%? Answer? Punters. Normal people like you and me. What drove it all? Greed. What is it that creates Far Eastern sweatshops where factories are unsafe and child labour dominates so that you and I can go to Primark and buy cheap clothes or maybe more expensive shops and buy cheap clothes? What is it? Greed. Why is it that despite a welfare state, there are still children in Chippenham going to bed hungry tonight? Isn't that a sign of a godless society? How can there be on our news screens a sentence where a young mum in Africa is sentenced to death just for being a Christian. What drives that? How godless can a society be? And before we say, oh, it's all right, that's Africa, come back to our own land. How can standards of morality always be changing? Apparently as they are. So what was unacceptable 50 years ago is clearly acceptable now because people's view of, for example, marriage or cohabitation or whatever it is has changed. How can that be acceptable? How can a society, if a society behaves as if there is no God, and this passage makes it clear, how do you measure godlessness in a society? Well, there's lots of ways, but I guess fundamentally you measure it by God's word. In other words, if you've ever wondered if there is or will ever be a stop point in the world, if there's ever justice in the world, if the rot will be stopped in the world, this chapter, Revelation 18, tells us God's answer is yes. Yes, there is. Godless society will not go on just doing its own thing all the time with the news editors choosing what they put on our screens. There will be a stop. And he calls Christians, that is those who are his people, who trust in Jesus and not themselves or in the society, he calls on Christians to do all they can to distance themselves, not from the society, but from the godlessness. Not to distance themselves from the society, from helping to alleviate it, quite the contrary. They're to be at the forefront of that, as they always have been, Wilberforce, Shaftesbury, Barnardo, and so on. And not to move to monasteries, but to come out from indulging in that society, to resist becoming a rat in the race. To use Peter's language, to be in the world but not of it. Now, what does that look like? That has all sorts of implications for you and me, doesn't it? As you look on this godless society and the smoke of the burning rising and the power brokers and the merchants and the sea captains watching it happening, what are the implications of that? What does it look like for you and me Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday to come out of a godless society in that sense? Well, look through the participants and their comments again. See, it must surely cause us to ask questions of how sold we are on the power games of a godless society, the kings of the earth and so on. They flirted with it. They benefited from it. They used it and it used them. Look at the power games of a godless society. How important is that idea in your life? Before you answer, how much score do you put on your place in society and how people regard you? How important is it that people think that you're at the top of whatever tree you're in? Is your identity all caught up with that, what the world thinks of you, or for being a Christian? See, if you're a Christian, you don't need to be caught up with what the world thinks of you in that sense. You don't need to find your meaning or fulfillment in life in such things because you found that in Jesus as King. He is at the center of the universe. He's the one who deserves all the honor and glory. Let me frame it another way. If you could be arrested for being a Christian, and who knows whether that will come again in our country. 350 years ago, it was true. It may come again. If you could be arrested for being a Christian, would you say, yes, I am, or not? There are places where Sat7 is reaching into where that is true. Would you say, that's me, or not? It's a challenge, isn't it? Maybe not a challenge for tomorrow, but it might be a challenge for 20 years' time. And what about the merchant's cry? Imagine that you found yourself in such a place, like some of the Christians in the opening letters of Revelation were, in Sardis and Thyatira and so on. Imagine for a moment that you found yourself in a place where you were thwarted from buying or selling because of your faith. Would your world end? How important are luxury goods or the latest fashion to you? And would you feel unfulfilled or out of it if you couldn't indulge? Maybe you and I need to reassess our value system, because the truth is that however smart the car, however cool the computer, or however slick the suit, or however cool the makeup or whatever the clothes, the truth is that one day it's all going to burn. That's what this says. Now that's a challenge. It's a challenge to how we spend money. It's a challenge to how we value everything. Does your value system really reflect what's really important and will really last forever, as you have the freedom as a Christian to do? Or is the truth that the godless society around us just can't tell the difference between us and it? In other words, are you supporting that society or not? That's the challenge of this passage. Come out, says the voice from heaven, because the plagues are coming. Or is coming out just too painful? Do you think of yourself primarily as a member of society or primarily as a Christian? This is written so that we do the latter. And with the sea captains, hey, maybe this is the most challenging question of all. Because it seems to me what this has to do with you and me is to ask the question, does my job rely on society being godless and living to excess? Does my life's work rely on this stuff? And if I have a choice, can I change? Would I change what I do? Maybe what I need to do is spend my time on something more productive for eternity than simply supporting what is one day going to burn anyway. You see, when it all comes crashing down, the world looks on to see, and the perspective from heaven, the eternal perspective, verse 20, is this. Heaven says, rejoice over her, O heaven, this burning heap. Rejoice, saints and apostles and prophets. Saints there just meaning Christians. God has judged her for the way she treated you. And the problem is when we look at this stuff, at the power and the luxury and the purpose, and you kind of say, I don't want to step out of this stuff because I'm going to get rejected by godless society and life will be tough. Listen, it will be tough. But it's okay because it's all going to burn. God has judged her for the way she treated you, says verse 20. And the vision of John is written so that we can view the world from a right perspective. We must not shy away from what will happen. The rat race has stopped. The participants are shocked. But God's justice, finally, is complete. Look at verse 21 as we draw to a close. Then a mighty angel picked up a boulder the size of a large millstone and threw it into the sea and said, with such violence, the great city of Babylon will be thrown down. What happens to a millstone in the sea? It drops literally like a stone, unliftable. With such violence, the great city of Babylon, the godless society, will be thrown down, never to be found again. The music of harpists and musicians, flute players and trumpeters will never be heard in you again, verse 22. No workman of any trade will ever be found in you again. The sound of a millstone will never be heard in you again. Verse 23, the light of a lamp will never shine in you again. The voice of a bridegroom and bride will never be heard in you again. Your merchants were the world's great men. By your magic spell, all the nations were led astray. And it's all stopped. Who does this include? Oh, I don't know most of the merchants, the world's great men, but some of you might. Where's Bill Gates going to fit into all of this? Stopped. Bang. I can't think of any other famous merchants. But can you see the desolation? Godless society will one day be judged, will one day be destroyed, and will one day be over. To answer the question, what will it do after that? The answer is clear. Nothing. Nothing. And it's all because, we're told, God values his people. He loves them. He sent Christ to die for them. He will save them. And he counts the cost of them, verse 24. In her, in the godless society, was found the blood of the prophets and the blood of the saints and of all who have been killed on the earth. Godless society ultimately hates God's people, because as they separate themselves from it and they live as if it isn't the most important thing, but he is, so they find themselves rejected. And one day, says this passage, so it will be. One day, so it will be. Where do you and I sit in all of this? Challenged by our value system? Sure, I hope. But recognizing that actually we are all caught up in this. And it makes us shudder were it not for the truth that Jesus has died so that we can be at home, not in a godless society, but in heaven with him forever.